Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our Hideaway studio here in East County. I am back from vacation and a lot has happened in the last 2 weeks. Now, the rest of our staff is still off for a couple more days, so today I'll be reading some of the top national and local news, and then we'll be airing our newsmaker interviews today with three local refugees who are now working with Nile Sisters, and they'll be sharing their compelling stories about how they escaped violence in their home countries and what it means to them to be living here in America. The Republicans held their national convention and nominated Donald Trump as their candidate for the presidency, and this week the Democrats are holding their national convention to nominate Hillary Clinton. Trump promised to lead our country back to safety, prosperity, and peace while restoring law and order, stopping illegal immigration, and suspending all immigration from countries compromised by terrorism, in his words. He spent much of his speech blasting Hillary Clinton on issues ranging from the economy to foreign policy to controversies over her private email server. In an unusual move, several of the nation's most respected newspapers issued scathing editorials denouncing Trump immediately after his convention speech. One of those was the Washington Post, which concluded a Trump presidency would be dangerous for the nation and the world. The Post called the real estate tycoon unqualified to serve as president in experience and temperament, adding he is mounting a campaign of snarl and sneer, not substance. The Post slammed Trump's politics of denigration and division, concluding that they could strain the bonds that have held our diverse nation together. The Post voiced grave concerns over Trump's contempt for the Constitution and suggested that his presidency could even threaten our nation's democracy. Moreover, the Washington Post, the major newspaper in our nation's capital, concluded that in a dangerous world, Mr. Trump speaks blithely of abandoning NATO, encouraging more nations to obtain nuclear weapons, and cozying up to dictators who, in fact, wish the United States nothing but harm. Now, while some Republican leaders did fall in line to endorse Trump, one of his most prominent opponents, Ted Cruz, did not. Trump's wife, Melania, also addressed the convention, drawing controversy for plagiarizing two paragraphs from a speech delivered by Michelle Obama at a Democratic convention. Trump announced that Indiana Governor Mike Pence, a staunch conservative, will be his vice presidential running mate. Pence is most known for the national controversy he created last year when he signed into Indiana law a bill that would extend protections to businesses that refuse services to same-sex couples. He also signed abortion restrictions into law and has said he does not believe in the scientific findings regarding climate change. Also a former member of Congress, Pence voted for the Iraq War, supported privatizing Social Security, opposed raising the federal minimum wage, and voted against the Affordable Care Act. Democrat Hillary Clinton has announced Virginia Senator Tim Kaine as her vice presidential choice. Senator Kaine has a strong record of supporting civil rights and women's reproductive freedoms despite being a Catholic. He speaks Spanish and could help Clinton outreach to Hispanics, a major voting bloc. However, some liberals have voiced disappointment that Clinton did not choose a minority, also voicing dismay in Kaine's close ties to big banks and support for the financial industry and free trade agreements. Senator Bernie Sanders, who has endorsed Clinton, is expected to speak tonight at the Democratic Convention in Philadelphia. The convention got off to a rocky start after WikiLeaks published leaked emails showing that DNC Chair Debbie Wasserman Schultz actively worked to undermine Sanders' campaign. Some DNC emails suggested Sanders be smeared as an atheist, although he is Jewish. The revelations have angered Sanders' supporters and led Wasserman Schultz to announce she will resign, but only after the Democratic National Convention. Now she's been hired on by the Clinton campaign, rubbing salt in the wounds of offended Sanders backers. The Democrats have also reached a compromise to pare back the number of superdelegates. A petition signed by a half million Democrats urged abolishing the superdelegate system completely as unrepresentative. The compromise will require that about two-thirds of all delegates pledge to support nominees in proportion to votes received in their states in the future, essentially making them pledged delegates. Only superdelegates who are state governors or members of the House or Senate would be free to vote for a different candidate. Now, speaking of politics, if you are interested in running for political office yourself to make a positive difference right here in your community in San Diego County, the filing period is now open with a filing deadline of August 12th. In East County alone, there are more than 50 public offices, including city councils, mayors, school boards, water and fire boards, hospital boards, and community planning groups. There is no filing fee. However, there is a cost for a ballot statement, and in most districts, that's between $100 and $200. You can get more information on this at the San Diego County Registrar of Voters website. Sometimes seats for these local races are won by people running unopposed, or if nobody runs at all, then seats can be filled by appointment. So this is a good opportunity for public service-minded people to get involved and help make positive changes in your community. In other news, a devastating wildfire, the Sand Fire, has burned over 33,000 acres in Los Angeles County's Santa Clarita Valley, forcing evacuation of thousands of people and threatening many homes. One person has died in that fire. And one of our local animal rescue groups, Lions, Tigers, and Bears, based in Alpine, has been actively helping evacuate exotic animals from a large wildlife facility that's threatened in that fire. Now, this is a very fast-moving blaze, so if you happen to be traveling north of Los Angeles, be sure to use caution and check the news for updates. Smaller fires briefly threatened homes in Lakeside, Ramona, and the Barona Reservation during the past few days, but fortunately, these were contained with no structure damage or injuries. One of those fires was started by mowing equipment at midday, and CAL FIRE asks that you restrict mowing and weed whacking activities to only the early morning hours and avoid such activities completely during high winds. From Public News Service today, we'll have some information on a new federal effort to help Californians afford to go solar. We'll have all these stories and more on today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters.
You're listening to East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso.
Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our Hideaway studio in East County. Today, I am delighted to be back again with some staff members from Nile Sisters, a wonderful organization locally that helps refugees, immigrants, and asylees.
Yes.
So I have with me Elizabeth Liu. Welcome back.
Thank you so much. It's an honor to be here.
Elizabeth, I'd like to start by asking you, how much concern is there in the community of those who serve refugees and immigrants about this rise in anti-immigrant and anti-refugee rhetoric that we seem to be hearing from some in the political field, including, you know, obviously Donald Trump out there on the campaign trail?
Definitely, there is a huge concern in refugees communities. The concern is refugees, before they come to United States, they are screened, their backgrounds are checked by United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. Even their health is screened. They are checked against all kinds of diseases to make sure that when they are coming to United States, they are not bringing communicable diseases and they are not running away from their countries because of crimes that they've committed. So all refugees coming to this country, they're really safe and their backgrounds are very clear.
Yeah, it should be noted that we've certainly had a lot of things in the news lately about these horrific mass shootings in Orlando, the one in San Bernardino, but that out of all the mass shootings we've had in recent years in the United States, only a small handful were actually Muslims. And in the case of the Orlando one, it was not an immigrant or a refugee. It was a U.S. citizen that committed the crime. And the vast majority of these mass shootings have been committed by white males who were citizens of the United States and born here. So, you know, there seems to be perhaps a little bit legitimate kernel of fear, but it's often been overblown into scapegoating of a population when really the bigger problem is the people that are born right here in many cases. So we thought for today's show that it would be a good idea to actually put some voices, put some personal stories behind the local refugees and let our listeners hear from people who've actually come here from other countries and what they've gone through and what, you know, what it was like to be a refugee, to be an immigrant, and you know, now what it means to be an American. So I would like to first introduce Mr. Gayaton. Mr., welcome to the show.
Thank you, Miriam. It's a pleasure to meet you again, and I can't wait to, you know, enjoy the beautiful sun you get out there. Oh. So it's so amazing. I wish I could be you living here.
Well, we love it here in our hideaway studio. You came here from Haiti. You arrived in the United States in 2009. Now, Haiti has been very hard hit with earthquake and hurricane. Did you come here before or after those events?
I can say I was fortunate enough to leave the country right before the earthquake. Now, I get here in March 2009 and the earthquake happened in 2011. However, I was not leaving just because I wanted to leave my country. I was actually fleeing away just that I can save my life from all kind of stuff that is, you know, violent culture that is going on in Haiti.
So what happened? Tell us about that violent culture that made you feel compelled to leave even before the devastating earthquake and so forth hit your home country.
Actually, I started out very young, you know, as a young fellow, you dream all kind of dream, you know, as a kid, you want to be, you know, when you watch TV, this is what you want to be. And happened that I wanted to be a police officer to actually help my country. That I started working for the police force when I was 19 years old, very young. Mm-hmm. But there is a culture over there where the younger you are, the more they take advantage of you.
So what happened?
I entered the system with me not knowing, you know, the whole thing is going on. So they tried to use me as, you know, to commit all kind of stuff. And then
So the police wanted you to do wrongdoing, violent wrongdoing, or
that's correct. Like, you know, use my power, my, you know, all the training they give in the police academy, and then to actually use it against the actual population that you're serving. So when I see that, you know, it's never been my intention. I said, no, these are not my values. I want to keep my values. I want to be someone who's being helpful, not taking advantage of people.
So what happened when you refused to go along with that?
Oh, wow. Thank God I was out early. And I remember that was July. It was July 29th, 2009, when a group of guy came up with very long rifle. It was about 9 o'clock, and then point at me and say, today's still the time that you can save your life, but you have to follow what we say. So what they're trying to do, they wanted to actually use me because I was detached with the immigration. They wanted to use me as I can use some other people with different identity to get their passport, and then that they can flee from the country. And I said, well, I never wanted to do that. So they wanted me to agree that I will do everything they want me to do.
So they literally had you at gunpoint there trying to get you to break the law.
And that was gun pointed in my head, and it was awful.
So how did you get out?
So when that happened, and then I let immediately my parents, because at that time my mom was living in Florida. But again, never wanted to leave my country because I want to live in a place where I can say, you know, this is my culture,
sure,
this is my language. So when everything will happen, and then, you know, my only way out to save my life was take off. And then, so what I had to do is ask a tourist visa with Mexico. And then from Mexico, so I entered to Mexico, and from Mexico, and I entered to United States.
And did you come as an asylee?
Indeed. I get here in March 2009, and when I was asking for asylum, well, fortunately, American are great people, and I met judges. It is a long process, but thank God, so I were able to get my asylum.
Now, I know that many people coming here seeking asylum are actually put into detention centers now for a while they vet their backgrounds, be sure they're not terrorists or something. Did that happen to you?
Indeed. I've never understood it, because when I was living this situation, I thought, oh, no, that's too much because I'm suffering. But after a couple of years out, I do understand the process, and I can tell you immigration actually have a very fair process as far as like processing people.
Now that's good to hear. How long were you in a detention center, and how were you treated in there?
I was in detention for about 3 months. So, because I was a police officer back home, so I get used to guns. So they wanted to make sure that I'm not representing a threat for the country. So they did all kind of backgrounds. And then while the process was still going on, so I was still in detention until 3 months, they finally cleared me out and then they released me.
And was that here in San Diego?
That actually was in San Diego.
So when you got out, what kind of help or resources were there for you? How difficult was it to get back on your feet and start a new life here in San Diego?
Man,
back in 2009?
Don't ask this question again. It was actually, I'm laughing, but it was pretty sad because
imagine.
When I get to state, I didn't, you know, well, my mom was in Florida, but I didn't have anybody around San Diego. And you know how the culture is in the United States. Everybody's over with bills and stuff like that. So as much as they want you, but sometimes they don't have the immediate support for you. So when I get to San Diego with having nobody around here, so it was kind of, you know, lost in the desert. So you don't know where to go. So I think, the first thing, you know, after a couple of weeks trying to get out around and then meet some new people, one person told me, hey, have you checked with Null Sisters? And I'm like, well, I don't know where it is. Can you drive me? So that's when they drove me to Null Sisters. So when I went there, I can tell my impression would be, oh, these people would not be able to help me. But when I get to sit down and they counsel me, they share my case, and it was very helpful.
Yeah. Well, obviously, it looks like you're successful today. I'm reading off your business card. This is very impressive.
Thank you.
I see that you have a Caribbean talent talk show. Where does
that
air?
That's why. We actually, you know, and all this thing is to, you know, showcasing value to tell people, no matter your language, no matter your background as far as culture, country of origin, you still can put it together. The only thing you know is give yourself a purpose. And if I were able to make it from nothing to where I am now, and I can tell you, well, I was blessed enough to put together a TV talk show. It's actually air on with Time Warner Cable.
And, very good. Time Warner Cable.
We have a Facebook page. If you'd like, you can check us out on Facebook with Caribbean Talent Talk Show. And, you know, I've worked for a very great company out there, and they do value my skills. So
yeah, I see that you do production services, photo, video, script. You're an actor, a director, and an interpreter of Spanish, French, and Creole.
That's
very impressive.
As of right now, I do work for the court as a court interpreter, as a normal job, because I need to keep fighting because I am involved in so many causes and I need financial assistance to do that. And beside of that, so I just graduated with a double major in documentary and film production. So that was my goal.
Congratulations.
You know, thank you. So I can tell you, and all these things is the base is Null Sisters because they were the first people to trust in me and tell me that I can do it.
Very good. And how concerned are you about what we're hearing out on the campaign trail with Donald Trump and all of his rhetoric about wanting to deport immigrants and so forth? How does that make you feel?
Politics, it has never been something that I was thinking in doing and even participate in the debates. But I can tell you from last year, you know, I pay more attention to what is going on in politics now, especially having some candidates that actually using our causes to do their political film. And I can tell you, honestly, it is very unfair. The fact that someone would actually, you know, use sometimes they don't realize that, but it is violence. When you're using this kind of language or this kind of words against a type of people. Now, I came to the United States as a refugee, but I can tell you, since I get to the United States, I've never steal not even one penny Of course, mm-hmm. I was born and raised in a violent, in a culture of violence.
Yeah.
But doesn't mean that I'm a bad person. And if I'm able, if I'm seeking asylum in the United States, it's because I want to be someone different than so many other young people in my country.
Right.
So someone who enters the United States testify clearly they don't want to be a violent person. And not only that, as I mentioned earlier, spending that much time with the U.S. Border Patrol authorities to go through checkpoints and background. So they know for sure the people that they are releasing are safe for this community.
Yeah.
So if someone's saying that the reason that they talking like that is because they want the country safer, I would say no, this is a lie, because they know exactly where the issue is. So they know how to solve it. And I'm very glad you asked this question, because although now I do have my residency, I am legal in the United States, I'm still fears what can come next year,
yeah,
what can come after the election.
The uncertainty has got to be troubling. Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us today on the show and sharing your personal story and much of which I think should be very inspiring to other new refugees or immigrants who are listening, that even though it's very, very difficult, that there can be a light at the end of the tunnel and that you can still be successful and achieve that American dream here that so many immigrants for so many hundreds of years have been able to do.
Well, I thank you very much. And last thing I probably would add to that is that never let your dream go away, because no matter where you come from, as long you positive, you know the reason you're here, there are people out there that can help you. Knock the right door and you will have the answer.
Very good. Thank you so much. Our next guest today, back with us once again, is Saharo Noor. And Saharo is from Somalia. She emigrated here in 1994. Welcome back to the show, Saharo.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
So please tell us, if it's not too difficult, what conditions were like in Somalia back in 1994, why you decided that you needed to leave.
Oh, the reason I'm live in my country, and back home when I live, registered nurse, and also I'm midwife. I have great life, but one night somebody attacked us to come. I say we fight a civil war, which is two tribe. They fight each other. So middle of the night, we run away in our house. I am naked that night.
I didn't have
nothing. I walk and run in my house and my jewelry, my money, my everything. Because that time you becoming numb. You're not feeling anything. I'm thinking already you gonna die in few minutes later.
That must have been absolutely terrifying.
Yeah. So it's kind of very, very trauma when I remember that things. So, middle of the night, I running, and I didn't know I have one child.
So you had no clothes on, you were running. I mean, that must have been humiliating.
I'm pregnant at that time, and I have one child, and I'm running in a naked, and I see all the people, they running in the neighborhood, and
you were,
they keep bombing, and the people, they die in front of me. The first fear I have that night and that day, the woman, she is pregnant and she have a baby, and her baby doesn't have neck. And while when she running, I see her baby, they get big gun shoot, and the baby go out, and then still, I'm alive, but I thinking I'm dying. So I'm running, keep running. And then we come in a little jungle in the morning, and the jungle, they have a lot of snake. They have a lot of, fear animal we never hear and we never seen it before. And then after day, they found us, United Nations. They found us and they brought to, border country, which is Kenya.
So you were traveling with one young child and you were pregnant with another at the time.
Mm-hmm. So my child born in Kenya, that 9 months that time. So, we, refugee come in Kenya and then United Nations, they take care of us. And then they brought here in the United States in 1994. We are in refugee camp 1 year.
So you were in the refugee camp for how long after you escaped from Somalia?
Actually, 91, 92, 93. 3 years.
So your child was, one child was born there and you
born
were
born there. So when I come in here, my daughter, she was 3 years.
And was your husband with you? Did you have other
he
family?
Didn't come that day. He ran somewhere else. And then other days or other months, we didn't see 1 year. 1 year later, we found each other in Kenya.
Oh, so you didn't know what had happened to him for all that
I
time?
I didn't know he's alive. He didn't know I'm alive. So we meet in Kenya and in refugee camp.
So then were you able to come to America together as a family?
Yeah, we came together and we at that time we have two child and I'm pregnancy again and we come in here.
Oh my goodness.
So I have 5 children and they, 3 of them, they born in here. They are succeed. They go to university.
Very good.
And my daughter, she graduated UCSD and now her master's, she graduated San Diego State and we just sacrifice our children to be, you know, one of one day they becoming like succeed. But I lost my, my job, my everything, my education. Oh. I busy with them. I didn't catch up my education, but I work in as a like community health worker, whatever job in available now, I get it because I didn't have my chair.
Yeah.
So I'm happy to live in America.
Oh, well, that's wonderful to hear. I'm so glad that things have
worked
out well for you and your family once you got here.
Yeah, we are safe.
Was it difficult when you first arrived? Were there very many resources?
The first time when we come in here is so difficult that it's that night, when I come in America is in a 50 area, which is the apartment they're renting for us is a full of cockroach. I never seen it cockroach in back home.
Cockroaches.
Or in refugee camp. So it's that night is a nightmare. I think in another hard life, I had it, but, after a while, I become a normal, you know, cultural shock. It's very hard, you know, but little by little, you catch up.
Yeah, I would imagine the differences in the dress and the diet and the culture.
We come in here, the cockroaches there in the morning. I see the people who get the, digging in the trash and I say, oh my goodness, the reason you're coming in America, they kill us or something like that.
Oh my goodness.
But
I shouldn't laugh, but you sound so brave and so courageous.
Yeah,
surviving,
but the,
after running
that,
from soldiers, naked in the forest and the refugee camp and then you're,
yeah, the first night I get the negative.
Our American cockroaches was too much.
The first night I meet the negative, but after that, the IRC, organization who brought here, they coming in the morning, they move us to another apartment and they helping us and we cultural shock, but we catch up and we great now today.
Beautiful.
Well, yeah. We thankful for America.
So glad to hear that.
Yeah.
And do you have concerns? I'll ask you the same question that I ask of Wister, but do you have concerns about the political rhetoric that we're hearing right now targeting refugees and immigrants who've been through these ordeals?
Yeah, we really have concern as a Muslim refugees, but, and also I hear bad news, which is happening last Sunday. We saw, you know,
the Orlando shooting.
Yeah. The things is happening. When they say, when we hear it, the Muslim did this, when the Muslim did that, we scared more and we fear a lot. And we, Muslim is a religion and the religion is not the target. The religion is something worship you and God. But as a refugee, still we need and helping in America and we becoming citizenship and anything of against America, we try to, you know, bag and push and, you know, we're not happy to hear that things, but You know, when they say that religion name, when they keep doing it, Muslim is a human being. They have a religion. That religion is a peaceful. It's not something they say killing or doing something, but you know, the human being, they have bad person, good person. And the religion is nothing with anything violence or anything against it to America.
Yeah, it's like with so many things. It's just a handful of individuals.
It's to worship you and your God. The Christianity and the Muslim is the same, but it's the same to worship a God. But the people, they are have a violence, they doing something unnecessary, they doing something harming for the other people. It's nobody like it, and we're not involved, and we against it too. Whatever is harming to us or to harming in America, we have to be helping, and we have to be communicate and, you know, see, helping each other. But we have a feel when they keep doing it, Muslim do this, Muslim do that, Muslim that this. We so fear, and we say, what are we going to do? What with the religion doing to the people? Religion is not weapon. Religion is not nothing. It's peaceful. It's something you're reading and you next to the God and, you know, worship your God and your faith. But there are a lot of people, they becoming now ISIS, Al-Shabaab. We hear all that things. We not happen to hear that, and we have a fear in the future, our children, when they, what they doing in the future, what's going on.
Scapegoating any group of people.
Yeah.
Based on a religion is always dangerous. You know, we should point out that throughout history, we've certainly had, for example, Christians who did bad things, who burned down, say, a black church, or who, you know, attacked an abortion clinic. And we don't seem to hear this, my goodness, let's deport all the Christians, or let's blame every Christian because somebody does a bad thing, you know, and yet that seems to happen all too often, I think, with people of the Muslim faith. So we really need to all keep our guard up and remember how dangerous it can be to stereotype a broad group of people based on the actions of a handful of individuals. I really want to thank you, Saharo, for sharing that compelling story with our listeners.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to have you today and meet you.
Okay. Elizabeth, I'd like to go back to you now. Listeners, if you just tuned in, we're speaking now with Elizabeth Liu, the founder of Nile Sisters. Now, Elizabeth, you came over to America yourself before our last two guests. I believe you came over here from the Sudan way back in 1999.
That's true. I came to United States in 1999, and when I arrived here in San Diego, I found the culture of the land is different from the culture where I came from.
Tell us what made you decide to leave the Sudan.
I love my country. I love Sudan very much. But as much as I love it, there is no peace in Sudan. I am born and raised in war. My entire life, I do not know peace, and I've never stayed in one place for long.
You were very young when you were forced to leave the Sudan. I know you've told me before, but it's worth letting our listeners hear it again about a story where the soldiers came to your school.
Yes, my parents took refuge with me to Uganda. By then I was a little kid. And in 1970, I was put to school up to when Idi Amin's soldier took over from Obote in 71. Yeah. So when Idi Amin took over from Obote, I remember that morning was so chaotic. And Idi Amin's soldiers were collecting Obote soldiers from checkpoints, from army barracks, from all the stations. And it happened that one of the soldiers just ran from his life, trying to hide. And this soldier ran straight to our school, and from our school to our classroom. Our school was close to the barracks. That's why.
So then what happened?
When this soldier entered our classroom, you know, small children, we were just small children, and we started screaming and crying and yelling and trying to compete to get out. The door was so narrow. Every child was trying to get out because of fear. And sooner than later, those Amin's army ran after this soldier, and we thought, because we are all children, they would sympathize and not be violent in our classroom. But they just dashed after this soldier, grabbed him. One man pulled a knife from the gun, and two were tying this other man down. So the other one pulled the bayonet. How do they call it?
Bayonet.
Bayonet, and just stabbed the man.
So they stabbed him in front of the children.
They stabbed him right there in our classroom. And we could hear the man screaming for his life, and blood was everywhere in our classroom. And at that moment, you can just imagine how terrified small children were.
So, as I recall, you fled after that. You ran, and you ran, tried to go back home. And what happened then?
Yes, when the soldiers tied this man and pulled him out and just threw him in a big army truck, and they left. So the headmaster blew whistle. I can remember all the steps, everything. He blew whistles, and so all the students came out, and he said, everybody must leave. Everybody leave, go to your homes, go find your parents. And from that point, I started running from school back home to locate my parents.
And when you got home, what did you find?
My parents left. Everybody has deserted the homes, the village.
So what did you do?
So I continued running, and I was following the path where we used to go to get water from the stream. And so I ran my hardest. I really ran. And I felt like my chest was bursting because of running so fast and long time.
And then you finally did find your family, right?
Finally. I did not even find my family that time. I found friends and relatives, because village is village.
Yeah.
People know each other. Everybody knows everybody. So I heard people were whispering in the bush, and so they saw me. One of them just grabbed me quickly and put me on his chest, and I was breathing like this. I was so tired. And they told me, the muscle, don't talk. Never open your mouth to ask a question or even cry.
Because the soldiers may
hear us or will hear us and come to where we are, and that will be the end of our lives.
So how did you find your family?
After the situation settled, and then people, of course, get out from the bushes and start looking for each other to check who is missing and who is where. So that was the time I reconnected with my parents, and then we all reconnected, and that's when my parents took over to take care of me.
Yeah. Now, a long time passed. That was in the early 70s, and you came to America in 1999?
Right.
So why did it take so long?
It took long. After we stayed in Uganda for several years, in 1972, a peace agreement was signed between the rebel group and the government. Mm-hmm. So my parents returned home to Sudan, and that was called Addis Ababa Agreement. And after that, I continued going to school. I finished my education, my high school, and then I made a home. I met my husband. Mm-hmm. So we started making a family. And sooner than later, another war broke out, which is dragging up to now, and that was in 1983-84 when this war broke out. And so again, it puts us, the citizens, in disarray.
Yeah.
People start running again, leaving their homes, their villages, their cities, looking for a safer place. And that was the time my husband and I relocated from South Sudan to Khartoum in 1988.
Khartoum?
Yes, mm-hmm. In Khartoum, Sudan. Yes.
And then eventually you made your way here in 2009, just because the violence continued, the war continued?
Yes. While we were in Khartoum, we lived in Khartoum for 8 years. And again, there was no peace in South Sudan. And also employment opportunity and even safety, the very basic safety, how we, the intellectuals, the educated, the people who are very resourceful, connected with the outside world, viewed.
Mm-hmm.
So we became a threat because my husband was working for United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. And at that time, it wasn't safe because the government feels that you are sharing information of the country to the outsiders.
So your lives were threatened at that point?
Yes, at that point. So the office decided to post him to Kenya,
mm-hmm.
because it wasn't safe for all of us.
Mm-hmm.
And so he came to Kenya first, and a few months afterwards, he arranged for us to leave Khartoum to join him in Kenya. We were in Kenya for 3 years, and then after 3 years, again, there is no peace. We did not see how we can return and be safe in Sudan. So we made the arrangement. We applied to refugee status with the High Commissioner for Refugees,
mm-hmm.
and we undergone all the screening process, our fingerprinting to make
everything,
sure,
yeah.
we are not criminals,
mm-hmm.
Health checked. We were all screened to make sure we don't have communicable diseases,
yeah.
HIV or tuberculosis, and all those checked. So then after that, we were given the status to travel to come to United States as refugees.
So did you come directly to San Diego?
Yes. Although our original destination was to go to West Virginia.
Really?
Yes. But when we got to New York,
mm-hmm.
That decision changed. I don't know how.
Yeah. Now, when you arrived here in San Diego in 1999, of course, there was no Nile Sisters. You went on to file that, to found that later on. How difficult was it for you to come to this country and to adapt to a new life here?
It was very difficult. I struggled a lot, but I'm very grateful. Even if I struggle a lot, it was not like that I do not know how to read and write. I am very passionate to become self-sufficient. I want to stand on my own feet,
mm-hmm.
and not to depend on public assistance for long. Also, I want to be able to help others who are coming after me. So I learned very quickly how to get the basic services, including health, driving, getting job. I worked hard and got a job the second month. My husband got a job the first month, and I got the second month, and we are off welfare. And so since I experienced the struggle of how it is to get integrated in the system, then I thought to myself, I said, I think I need to form a support group,
yeah.
for those who are coming after me.
So
and that was the beginning of
Nile Sisters, and the,
yes.
rest, as they say, is history. So tell us very briefly about what Nile Sisters is all about.
Nile Sisters is a community-based organization, 501c3. We are helping refugees who are coming from war-torn countries in Africa, people from Burma. We have also people from Middle East, like the Afghanistan, Iraqis, Syria, and all those who are fleeing from Middle East to United States, to San Diego. We also have our newest population we are serving coming from Haiti. They have the same struggles. And across the border, we have immigrants from Mexico as well. This population, we help them to have skills that they can use here in the United States. They can get a job and be on their feet. Some of the services we provide are certified nursing assistant. This is a job, a career that gets job instant.
So you provide actual education programs, very concrete programs where people can get a degree or a certificate and then be able to go out and get a good paying job so they can be self-sufficient.
Very good. Yes, yes. And we have home-based business, health, childcare business. Mm-hmm. And, for those who have maybe a limited English or yeah. those who have a business career, they want to build on, whatever they have before.
Yeah. A lot of people that come here, they are mothers already. They have right. children, and it's very difficult to go out and find an outside job when you have to take care of your children, and even being able to afford childcare would be a hurdle. So that's a good career opportunity for somebody.
Right. Right. Thank you so much.
Stay home with their kids.
Yes, for adding that. Thank you. For those who have just come, maybe they don't have driver's licenses yet. We know how important it is. We do driver's education and training so people can be able to look for a job and be able to help their families.
Very good. Well, I know there's a number of other wonderful programs that you offer, and listeners, if you want to learn more about that, Elizabeth, what is the website where people can go to learn more about Nile Sisters or get involved, volunteer, make a donation if they want to help?
To access our information, you go to www.nilesisters.org, or you can send us a mail at 6035 University Avenue, Suite number 22, San Diego, California, 92115.
Very good. I want to thank you once again for joining us today on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice.
Thank you, Miriam. It's so nice to be with you, and thank you for the opportunity given to Nile Sisters.
You're welcome.
You're listening to East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso.
The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show.
The Obama administration announced plans Tuesday to make solar an option for all homeowners by extending more zero-down loans. As part of the Clean Energy Savings for All initiative, the Veterans Administration and the Department of Housing and Urban Development will start insuring mortgages on homes with a PACE loan. PACE is a program that allows homeowners to finance solar and energy efficiency improvements without paying a dime up front and instead make payments through their property tax bill. California Governor Jerry Brown supports the program but says other government-sponsored organizations such as Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac should have been doing this all along.
This makes everybody better off, the homeowner, the environment, and FHA and VA. Why doesn't Freddie and Fannie do that? The Federal Housing Finance Agency, because of the mortgage meltdown, is so paranoid and so fearful, they won't step up to the plate and do the right thing.
The president's climate action plan originally set a target of installing 100 megawatts of solar by 2020, but the White House has now upped the goal by a factor of 10 to 1 gigawatt. Brown says this complements his stated goal of getting 50% of California's energy from renewable sources by the year 2030.
It is another important government effort to accelerate the movement toward renewable energy and efficient housing, so we're not wasting water, gas, or electricity, and we're using the sun as much as we can to get the job done.
As part of the plan, several housing agencies in California have committed to putting more solar on government-owned apartment complexes. The initiative will also increase job training for more solar installers to meet the expected rise in demand. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Next up from County News Service, we're going to be hearing from Larry Johnson out at the old Campo Stone Store, one of East County's most unique and colorful historical landmarks.
If you're ever on Highway 94, about an hour east of San Diego, you might see this unique building.
Welcome to Historic Campo and the Gaskell Brothers Stone Store Museum.
The Gaskell Brothers built a fortress-like stone store in 1885. Previously, it was a wooden structure, the site of a famous shootout.
A group of bandits had been raiding down the coast of California, so gunfire started. And there was a big shootout. The guy that they had shot on the floor, one of the Gaskell brothers, didn't kill him. He jumped up, grabbed a shotgun, went out and shot people. And so they were shooting dead blank range around. And both Gaskell brothers were wounded. The locals were afraid of another raid. They couldn't get the military up here to guard and protect them. So they thought they needed a substantial building. So that's why they decided to build a building as thick as this and as strong as this. If you take a look around, if you come in, you'll see that the walls down here are about 4 foot thick. It's from stone that was quarried here on site by hand with hammer and drill and no backhoes or heavy lifting objects. It was manpower. It served as a store from 1885 until about 1927.
No longer a store, this building is now a museum, thanks to County Parks and the Mountain Empire Historical Society. Today, the store reflects the early life of the town of Campo.
When the Historical Society began, they tried to make it look a lot like it did in 1899, or when it was a store functioning to serve the local public. So they have gathered some of the food stuff, the tobaccos, the medical supplies, the ropes, the cans, anything that the ranchers needed. If they didn't have it, you didn't need it.
The building is filled with photos, books, artifacts from the Kumeyaay Indians who occupied the region prior to the settlers, and other rare items.
These shackles were found locally about 3 miles from here on a ranch in about 1885. A person who's bought the ranch found in the well the skeleton. On the skeleton, on the legs, were these shackles. They didn't know who the body was or who the skeleton was. It's still a mystery today. One of the interesting things about these shackles is they're blacksmith made. There's no lock to them. Once they were on, they were meant to stay.
Upstairs is an impressive exhibit dedicated to Campo's military history, including Camp Lockett.
Camp Lockett was started before the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. I guess the military was anticipating that there was going to be a war, and they needed another base here, and they needed a base in this area because of the railroad, which was a key supply line. We had a long exposed border, and one of the things they were afraid of was that if the Japanese came into the war, they might invade Mexico and come into San Diego. So this was sort of a critical point, and so they started building Camp Lockett.
The 10th Cavalry is one you may have heard of.
The famed Buffalo Soldiers, white officers and then African-American enlisted troops. And they were stationed here, and they were guarding tunnels and railroad and the border. Very tough, very good soldiers.
The museum is open on weekends, making for a nice day trip to learn about our local pioneers.
They were entrepreneurs, every one of them. They were constantly trying to figure out how to make the best of what they had and where they were, and to make a living and to leave history and substantial items behind them so that descendants would have something to live and work on and hopefully try and take care of.
This is Connie Beck with Ready, Set, Grow. I'm going to help you create healthy and beautiful gardens using less money, less hard work, and much more fun.
I love mulch. Mulch is one of my favorite words because of what it does for us. Here in Southern California, we desperately need mulch. If you've traveled abroad, you've gone to France, you've gone to England, and you've seen that back there, they use something called dust mulch. This is where they go in with a little cultivator and they rake up a little pile of loose soil on the soil surface, and they view that as mulching. And it works for them because it rains about every 30 minutes over there. But we're in Southern California, and our sun is hot, and it blazes down. First, the definition of mulch is, it's anything that you use as a barrier between the sun and the soil. And that's probably the number one wonderful aspect of mulch. It will make your plants much happier. They will grow better because they won't be going through a constant cycle of I'm wet, now I'm hot, now I'm dry, now I'm wet. So the mulch is the blanket that provides a much more serene landscape for your plants. They will be much happier without going through the constant wet, dry, wet, dry, wet, dry cycle. You will also find that it will help your water bill because the mulch will help you stretch out between waterings. When you change and start using 3 inches of mulch, yes, 3 inches of mulch on your plants, you will find that you don't need to water nearly so often. Plants that you had to water every third or fourth day may go a week very easily between waterings. That's certainly going to be helpful. But there are other things that mulch does too. I've seen those gardens in France and England because I love to travel. But when I come home, I have no interest in spending another month weeding. That's not my idea of fun at all. The mulch makes it so that I don't need to weed all the time. 3 inches of mulch means that very few weeds are going to come up. You can pull the ones that do come up very easily because they're wimpy and they have weak stems. You can do it just by bending over and jerking them out of the ground. Now, this does take a little work up front. If you have a half an acre of weeds right now, you have to get down to bare ground before you put the mulch on them. So you will need a hula hoe, and hopefully you can then rake up the stuff and make it go away because it's going to be old dry weeds full of weed seeds. If you're doing this in the early part of the year when those weeds are still green, those make great compost additions for your compost barrel. Now, once you've got the bare ground, either around your existing garden or starting from scratch, put down 3 inches of mulch. The mulch can be either organic or inorganic. I personally do not care much for putting down weed barrier underneath things. When I put down mulch, I put it on the bare ground. People who are insecure about that could put down 4 to 6 layers of newspaper, and that would be good. Whatever you do, don't put down black plastic. Don't let anybody talk you into putting plastic underneath your mulch, because the black plastic is going to tear and the edges are going to come up. Soon, within 2 or 3 years, you will have these lovely pieces of black plastic floating around your landscape. This is not something that most of us want to see. What is the mulch? You can get leftover tree prunings. You can get leaves that you've run through a shredder. You can go buy wonderful mulch at either the Sycamore or the Miramar landfill. You can use whatever you have for mulch. You can also do inorganic mulches. You can put down half inch gravel. You can put down pea gravel. You can buy bark. There are so many choices that you can use. My favorite mulch of all time is called Gorilla Hair. Gorilla Hair is redwood that has, it's the leftovers from when they mill the redwood. And so it binds together beautifully. It's kind of a rusty color, which is why it has the name Gorilla Hair. And it lasts a long time. It's great for use on slopes. Try it. You'll like it.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Royalty Free Music, and Pond 5. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.